This is Upstate's Health Link on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. 1.5 million Americans will be diagnosed with cancer this year, and 1/3 of them will succumb to it, according to the National Cancer Institute. Diet, tobacco use, and other environmental factors, as well as lifestyle choices, have a well-documented role in causing many of these cancers, significantly more so than family genetics. But just where are we in our fight against this dreaded diagnosis? Well, here with some perspective on this is Dr. John Ceferin. He's the president of the American Cancer Society, and he's here to address the Upstate Medical University community at this year's commencement. But he's found time in his very busy schedule to share his thoughts with us. Welcome, Dr. Ceferin. Thanks for coming.
It's great to be here, Lena.
So, where are we in our fight against cancer? In other words, how far have we come and how much farther do we have to go?
Well, we've come a long way. I like to use the metaphor that for most of my life and my career, we were running into the woods, and for the first time now, we're running out of the woods. When my organization was founded, any serious diagnosis of cancer was a virtual death sentence, only to be preceded by a protracted period of pain and suffering. Now, 2 out of 3 people who get cancer survive on a long-term basis in the United States of America. Interestingly, we now have 28 million cancer survivors in the world. Would you believe 50% of them live in the United States, which has only 5% of the world's population?
Wow.
So we've truly come a long way. However, we're not out of the woods yet. We're running out of it, and we can see light at the end of the tunnel, pardon the mixed metaphor, but we have a lot yet to do. But the bottom line is that the most exciting thing for me is the knowledge that we have evidence today that we could bring cancer under control as a major public health problem in this century. Now, remember, we know that cancer has been around for thousands of years. We can document it in dinosaurs and Egyptian mummies.
Wow.
And to think that if we do the right thing, it could be eliminated as a major public health problem is just really dramatic. And I want to make sure that the listeners understand what that means. I'm not saying that we can prevent the malignant occurrence from ever occurring, but the fact that basically 3 out of 3 would survive the disease if they get it is an exciting prospect.
It's absolutely, it's staggering, actually, especially as you noted many, many years ago, this was a death sentence. Yeah. This the C word was one to shudder.
Absolutely.
And fear very greatly. How about things like early detection? Are we doing better with that? Is it saving lives? You know, and are these techniques that we're using most effective? I mean, I know that there's been some controversy around some aspects of early detection, the PSA, for example, breast cancer screening. Tell us about that.
Well, there's no question but what there are 3 important ways in which we can save lives from cancer. One of those, of course, and probably the most important, is to prevent it from ever happening in the first place. And we now know how to prevent over half of all cancers. So those 1.5 million that you mentioned at the outset, Linda, over half of those, we know what to do to keep this from ever happening during a normal human lifespan. The next step is what we sometimes refer to as secondary prevention, and that is getting it really early. And there's no question but what thousands and thousands of lives have been saved through early detection. Mammography is a good example. Mammography is not perfect, and we need a better test, but it has led to successive 20-year decline year over year in breast cancer mortality rates. I think of my wife, Carol. We just... my bride of 48 years, we just celebrated a wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. If she had been diagnosed with breast cancer when I got involved with the American Cancer Society when I was on faculty at Purdue University in 1972, she would have had to have had a radical Halstead mastectomy, a removal of the breast and the underlying pectoralis minor muscle. She would have had lymphedema, pain, and swelling in the arm as a result of it, and a 50% chance of living 5 years. Mm. Thankfully, she didn't get breast cancer then, but she did some 9 years ago. And she ended up with a lumpectomy, and the sentinel lymph node was clean, and so she will never die of that cancer. She's more at risk of other cancers because she's had cancer, but clearly her life was saved by mammography and early and prompt attention.
How about the treatment modalities these days? I mean, are we seeing, I know we are seeing some breakthroughs. They're doing things like looking for tumor markers. There's this whole idea of personalized cancer treatments where they're tailoring based on the genetic makeup of the particular mass or type of cancer. They're tailoring the kind of approach rather than that broad brush shotgun approach. Tell us about that.
I think it's a major part of the answer. You're absolutely correct. For most of my career, we had these really cytotoxic poisons And you tried to give the patient a sublethal dose, killing the cancer and hopefully not killing the patient. That sounds kind of crude, but that is not much of an exaggeration. Today, we are much more targeted in our approach with what is often referred to as targeted therapies. And Rene DeBow at Rockefeller many years ago in Man, Medicine, and Environment wrote, you know, more important than what disease a person has is what person has a disease. Mm-hmm. And so tailored treatment is here, and it'll only get better. Personalized medicine is the way we'll go. And eventually, one could argue that each patient will be treated somewhat differently so that you can match up what will help that patient the most and hurt the patient the least.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with American Cancer Society President Dr. John Ceferin, and we're talking about where we are in our fight against cancer. So the ACS just celebrated the 100th anniversary in the last year. What do you think the next 100 years has to hold if you look in your crystal ball? You said we're on the verge of basically beating cancer in many cases. What do you see about what's in the future for cancer?
Well, my dream is for us to bring cancer under control in this century, and I believe we can do it sooner rather than later. And that is such a profound statement from where we came from, because when our organization got started, we didn't have any answers. And then when I got involved, we had some ideas, but they had no proof. Now we have what I call proof of concept. We now are saving 400 more lives from cancer per day than we were in 1991.
That's staggering, frankly.
It gives me goose flesh. But I went to my board of directors 4 years ago in May and said to them, then it was 350, and I said, here's evidence that we're saving 350 more lives and published data. But here's evidence that it could be 1,000 a day if we do the right thing. So what I want our listeners to be mindful of is that we have to do the right things. And public policy has been an important part to solving this problem. But if we could get to 1,000 a day, that would be a public health victory, the likes of which the world has never seen. And if we can do that, then we could spread that throughout the world and talk about saving as many as 10,000 lives per day from cancer worldwide.
So now what are the right things? I mean, you led me right down that road. You obviously have some sense of what they are.
I do. There are three things there are three things that we have to do. We have to redouble our research efforts. And there's no reason that we can't, the things that we need to do, there's no reason we can't do them all, but there are big barriers to getting them done. But we need to redouble our research efforts. Research in my lifetime has gone from a good bet to a sure bet. That doesn't mean every experiment works, but it's a building block phenomenon, and we are getting answers. The more we stoke the engines of discovery, the more answers we're getting. Now, I can tell you specific stories about that, but the bottom line is we don't have all the answers. We need more research. Second, we have to promote prevention into public policy everywhere. As I said, over half of all cancers can be prevented during a normal human lifespan. That means changes in public policy. And the third thing is we have to provide access to quality health care to everyone who needs it. And interestingly, we need all three, and undergirding all three is advocacy. We have to get more people engaged in the fight against cancer. We can finish the fight against cancer in this century if we do the right things. To do the right things, we have to have people speak up and say, we need more money for research. We need to make sure that people are protected from secondhand smoke. And we need to make sure that if someone has cancer, they get the care they need. That's why the new Upstate Medical University's Cancer Center is so important. I said before we started the show, sometimes people exaggerate or use hyperbole. It's not hyperbole to say that when that cancer center opens in July, more lives are going to be saved. People will not die who otherwise would die if they didn't have access to that facility.
Wow. Well, prevention, you mentioned, is also a key component of this whole approach. Yeah, I think others have argued that if we used more vaccinations or antibiotics as well as improved hygiene, we could curb the incidence of cancer. Say more about prevention. Where does the public policy part of that come in?
Well, first of all, let me say something that many of the listeners might not have thought of or be aware of. But if you look at the history of medicine and public health, you're hard-pressed to find any major disease that was ever brought under control by any means other than prevention. So whether you're talking about smallpox or whether you're talking about measles and so forth. But bottom line is that prevention will be a very important part of solving the problem.
So is it better education, especially when it comes to things like tobacco use and all of that? I mean, that seems to be one of the big culprits. As a matter of fact, I just want to say that I noted in preparing for this interview that in 2008 you said that tobacco was the world's greatest weapon of mass destruction. And in 2011 you said that if companies could go completely tobacco-free, you could change the world. What did you mean, and tell us more about tobacco?
Well, tobacco is public health enemy number one. I believe, we don't have the data because we don't have good databases in some parts of the world, I believe that cancer has already become the number one cause of death in the world. It's a bit of an academic point. We know it's one of the top two or three causes of death. One in every eight deaths is caused by cancer, and tobacco, exposure to tobacco, is the single largest cause of cancer. We know that. There's a moral issue here, and that's the reason I talk about weapons of mass destruction. Basically, tobacco killed 100 million people in the last century. If we don't act, it will kill a billion people this century. That's never happened before in the history of the world that we know of. And so a billion unnecessary deaths is simply unacceptable. So the tobacco industry is an irresponsible corporate citizen that puts profits over people's lives, and we have to regulate tobacco and tobacco-related products, and we need to change social norms, and we need to have policies that protect people. We have, I think, one of the only, for sure, public-private partnerships with organizations like Johnson & Johnson, Department of HHS of the federal government, the Mayo Clinic, the American Cancer Society, and others to get smoke-free worldwide in terms of workplaces. Over a billion people go to work every day. Many of them don't smoke in order to try to be there for their family when they're needed, but go work and are exposed to carcinogens, and that's just unacceptable.
Absolutely. What do you think, you were talking about research as being crucial, okay? What effect, if any, has the sequester in Washington had on this? Has it really had a chilling effect on cancer research?
A devastating effect. And I just had a chance to visit with a good friend, Senator Tom Harkin, a few nights ago in Washington, and he's, of course, very concerned about it as well. We just can't back away. We worked hard with others. The American Cancer Society worked hard with other people and other organizations to double the NIH budget over a five-year period of time a decade ago, and it was done over two administrations, one Democrat and one Republican, because cancer is a bipartisan issue. Now, with sequestration and so forth, that's been eroded away, and we are at terrible risk. Number one, the value proposition: if you fund research, we can guarantee you answers. We couldn't 25 years ago. We can today. Number two, investing in research has economic value. It benefits the American public. We announced a 20% reduction in cancer death rates last year. That yields American public a $10 trillion value. So it would be hard for me to exaggerate, and I think it's a failure of elected officials doing their job for which they're being paid, because we need to fund more research, and if we do, we'll get this disease under control sooner, not later. The final point is really important, and that is, I believe we're 36 to 48 months from losing our place as the leader as a biomedical research epicenter in the world. We're going to lose our bench strength. The average age of a new R01 grant from the NCI is 41. That's not sustainable. These young people have to be able to be funded earlier, and so that their creative ideas can see the light of day.
Well, let's hope we get a little less dysfunction in Washington and we get these researchers going. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back with a lot more from Dr. Seffran. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with Dr. John Seffran, and he is the CEO of the American Cancer Society, and we're talking about how far we've come with cancer. Well, Dr. Seffran, I've heard so much about this progress we've made. Tell us a little bit more about it. You have a perspective on the progress, however. Tell us about that.
Well, we've made a lot of progress, and the evidence is clear. And as I mentioned, we have 1.2 million people who will celebrate a birthday this year who wouldn't have had if the death rates had stayed the same as they were in 1991. So it's a wonderful outcome. And indeed, the cancer death rates have gone down every year, year over year, for 20 successive years. And that yields the American public not only 1.2 million people who are still alive who wouldn't be otherwise, but it yields the American public a $10 trillion economic value. So it would be difficult to exaggerate the good news about cancer. However, there is a darker side. And I was asked a couple of years ago in my performance review, what kept me awake at night? And I said, I've never been frightened that the American public would stop supporting us because they see us in their communities doing things that they care about. However, what keeps me awake at night is knowing that most of the people who suffer today and who die today, 1,500 will die today, are dying and suffering needlessly. That wasn't true when I got involved as a volunteer 40 years ago. We didn't have answers. Now we have answers. And so it is a moral imperative that we get citizens engaged and take action, because we know if we do, we can save a lot more lives and reduce a lot of human suffering. And I think that's a moral imperative. Let me give you a concrete example, if I could. This is such great news. Guess what? Colon cancer is preventable. Now, here is like the second leading cause of death in men and women. And if we can get screening, we know that we can prevent a tremendous amount of colon cancers. And so the American Cancer Society has launched, with the Colorectal Cancer Roundtable and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a major first time ever nationwide initiative to screen people for colon cancer. And what we want to do is we have a goal of getting to 80 by 18. We want to get 80% of the age appropriate population to be screened according to our guidelines by 2018. It's a stretch goal. It's going to be a lot of work, but we think we'll get there. And if we do, we know that hundreds and over time thousands of lives will be saved.
Wow, that's really an incredible goal, and very exciting to think that. There are other new screening techniques that are coming out that also will save lives. I mean, very recently we've heard about this new lung cancer, low-dose CT scan that can diagnose lung cancer, otherwise the silent killer, early enough so that people's lives can be saved. Tell us about that.
Well, it's both exciting and scary. It's exciting because I happened to get started back in the 1970s and involved with American Cancer Society because of my interest in tobacco and lung cancer, and especially as it relates to kids getting addicted to tobacco. All of my life, nothing worked. X-rays, all kinds. I'd look at all this data, and it was so sobering and disappointing because you couldn't find the disease early. Now we've proven, in the American Cancer Society a few years ago, we had all of our divisions help us, and we recruited 50,000 people to get in the National Lung Screening Trial. And they shut the trial down because it became clear that with spiral CT scanning, you could detect lung cancer for the first time ever early enough that some patients could be treated and cured. I mean, that's a huge breakthrough on the one hand. On the other hand, unlike, say, cervical screening, harm can be done. If you find a lesion, and many people, including myself, have innocent lesions in their lungs because I grew up in Ohio Valley and in Indiana, and so you have little things there that are
what they call false positives.
Exactly. And so,
or false positives.
Exactly, false positives, but you have to go in and find out if it's something or not, and so some harm can come from that. So we're at a very interesting time, and we don't have all the answers yet, but without any question, if for example, someone has the history, a certain age, and so many pack years of experience, then probably they're well-served to be screened. But we want to be careful because we don't want younger people who don't have that same background to be screened unnecessarily because they might have some of these lesions like I do. And people can actually die as a result of some of the complications that go along with the workup. So it's a huge breakthrough. It's not an unmixed blessing.
Yeah, we did an interview here on this show not too long ago with our own cancer screening department and the lung cancer screening, and we were apprised of all of that. But it seems to me that a very highly trained radiologist can really look at those CTs and probably do a good analysis so to avoid the potential hazards with false positives.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's why access to quality care is so very, very important. And that's why the Upstate Medical University's new cancer center is going to save lives. And it's not an exaggeration to say that, because starting in July, people will have access to some of the latest technology and some of the greatest scientists and clinicians available anywhere in the world. And that makes a difference. And so what we have to be careful about is where someone gets less than state-of-the-art care.
Yeah, and the problem is that many people up until now have been without that care.
Absolutely.
Because of what? What's been the you were talking about that three-legged stool, excuse me, and this idea of access being one of the crucial things to fighting cancer. Tell us more about that.
Well, access to quality care has never been more important than it is today. And the reason for that is pretty simple. We've done a lot of research and we've had a lot of experience, and all of a sudden now we know things we didn't know before. But if someone doesn't have access to all of that, then they're out of luck. And so the bottom line is that we have to build out a healthcare system that really works. You know, it's interesting. We spend twice as much per person per year on healthcare as any nation in the entire world, and we get lousy results. We're 37th in the world in terms of life expectancy.
That's staggering.
About where Cuba is. And so we have an opportunity, though. We know there's that much in the way of human and financial resources in the system, and if it's applied and used differently, we can get phenomenally better outcomes where people live healthier longer. And oh, by the way, it's an economic imperative that we do that. The fact is that globally and in the United States, aging is a global and a United States phenomenon. People are living longer. And for many years, medical science was replete with halfway measures, doing better at keeping them alive than keeping them well. We have to keep people well longer. And if they are well longer and don't get a major cancer in their 50s, look at the contribution they make to their family and to society. Put differently, if they're disabled because of a non-communicable disease like cancer, it's a whole different story. They become dependent rather than a producer.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with American Cancer Society CEO, Dr. John Ceferin, and we're talking about where we are in the fight against cancer. Now, earlier in the interview, we were talking about tobacco. I know that's been your big, you know, challenge in the world and something you've been fighting against for a very long time. But there's a new wrinkle in this whole fight, this so-called e-cigarettes that are out there. And I know that there's a lot of questions, more questions than answers, as to the potential toxicity and whether this could be a gateway, especially for younger people, to then find their way to cigarettes. What are some of your thoughts about this?
Well, Linda, you said it well. This is, this is a real challenge for us. And the tobacco control community and the public health community, but particularly the tobacco control community is very split on this issue. On the one hand, it's conceivable that e-cigarettes could be the best harm reduction technology ever. It's conceivable, not proven. On the other hand,
at least that's their argument. How they advertise.
If you want
to quit smoking,
that's right.
Use our product.
Yeah. On the other hand, it could be a gateway drug, just as you suggest, because obviously it could allow young people, and it's being very much advertised with bubblegum flavoring,
exactly,
and so forth, and for them to become addicted to nicotine and then go to tobacco, which would be a catastrophe. Another issue that often isn't mentioned is the following, that one of the most, and I mentioned the other day, most of the people take for granted that it's not all right to light up in public.
Anymore.
and how different that was when I was an undergraduate student.
Where you were avant-garde and were sophisticated if you had a cigarette.
But you could light up in any restaurant. You could light up on an airplane. I mean, even smokers would oppose us putting smoking back on airplanes today. But this, then, could be a way in which we've denormalized tobacco use. And that's been a major thing to help us. You know, basically, we've reduced tobacco consumption by half. We now have, for the first time in the history of the Republic, more former smokers than active smokers.
Wow.
And we now are seeing declines in lung cancer mortality, not only in men, but now finally in women. So we're talking about huge progress here, and e-cigarettes could erode back the other direction, where all of a sudden it's okay to light up an e-cigarette in some of these places. And so there's a lot of concern here, but the most important point I might make here is that we should have the principle of protection, meaning by that we have to have evidence that something's safe before we allow it to be done. So we believe that the FDA should move forward with its deeming rules and control e-cigarettes just like it does regular cigarettes. It also should control other tobacco products like cigars and smokeless tobacco and e-cigarettes and force those companies to do the science and evidence as to what its harmful effects are or are not.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm hoping that FDA will take action. One of the things the American Cancer Society has, which is unique, is an incredibly powerful database. You know, you are the source people go to for information about cancer in this country, probably more than any other place. Tell us about that. How do you see that, and what role has it played in terms of defining research needs, helping to determine, you know, what's going on demographically in our country? Tell us more about that.
Well, we formed about a quarter of a century ago now, about 25 years ago, with the American College of Surgeons. The American Cancer Society established the National Cancer Database. And it was controversial at the time because we had SEER data, but this database is different because this database is the only database in America that has reliable numbers on stage of diagnosis. Is it stage 1, 2, 3, or 4? What are the 5-year outcomes and whether the person has insurance or not? And so out of that database, we were able to show during all the discussions about healthcare reform that a woman with stage 1 colon cancer that no one should die of was more apt to die than a woman with stage 2 colon cancer, which is more serious, who had insurance.
So if the stage 1 person did not have insurance and the stage 2 person did, basically the stage 2 person would survive.
That's right. And the important point here is that both were treated. So no one would be surprised if you don't have insurance and therefore don't have access to health care, you're more apt to present with a late diagnosis, with a more advanced tumor going into the emergency room or something like that. That happens. But there are also people who get diagnosed with early disease without insurance, and they still are more likely to die than someone with more advanced cancer with insurance. And that was proof positive that we had to do something to change public policy so that more people would have access to quality health care. There's no reason in the world, not one, that we can't provide state-of-the-art, world-class health care to every citizen in the United States of America. There's enough money in the system to do that. We just have to change public policy and find ways to get more people insured.
You yourself have, in the very little time we have left, I know you have a personal connection to cancer. You alluded to that earlier in the interview when you mentioned your wife, but you also had other family members who've been stricken with cancer. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I can. I think when I was 9 years old, my grandmother was diagnosed with colon cancer, and she went to the Indiana University School of Medicine hospital to be treated, came home, and we had to change our living room into a hospital room, and we got a bed on loan from the American Cancer Society. And over the ensuing weeks and months, she died a terrible death, and it impressed me greatly because she did not have good pain control, and she had no hope of survival. And when something is hopeless, it's pretty difficult on not just the patient, but the caregivers as well. Fast forward many years, my mother got leukemia. And while she did not survive that disease, it was some of the highest quality time that I've had with my family since I left to go to college, because we were with her and she had state-of-the-art treatment. And they said, here's a treatment we could do, but there's a 25% chance it'll kill you. And she just said, well, if I thought I could make it until Mary, my daughter's wedding, I'd try it, but since I can't, let's move on. And she said, who's got a joke? And my brother tried to comply with the joke, but we had some really quality time, and she died. But she died a far different death than my grandmother. And now my wife, who's now will never die of that cancer, had cancer, and an amazing experience because we spent a weekend holding hands and talking after her diagnosis, after the biopsy came positive. And she said, well, John, what are you going to say? And I said, what do you mean? We're just by ourselves. She said, the wife of the CEO of the American Cancer Society has got breast cancer. That's an item. But that year we changed our Thanksgiving plans, and she checked into the hospital at 7:30 in the morning on Wednesday, had a lumpectomy, and we walked in the back door of our house at 3:30 that afternoon, and for the first time in either of our lives had Thanksgiving dinner at home alone.
Oh, my.
And she'll never die of that disease. So we've made great progress. We're not there yet, but we have a chance, based on evidence, to bring cancer under control early in this century, and I hope we will.
I hope we will, too. And I think with you at the helm, there's a very good chance. You at the helm of the ACS is a very good chance. I want to thank you so much for coming in and taking the time to share some of your thoughts and perspectives on this very dreaded disease, which now, as you said, we have some hope, very hopeful news. My guest has been Dr. John Ceferin. He is the CEO of the American Cancer Society, and he spent some time telling us about his perspectives on cancer. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.